The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still, to a large extent,
live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Michael Albert is an organizer, publisher, teacher, and author of over 20 books and hundreds of articles. He co-founded South End Press, Z Magazine, and the Z Media Institute, and he works full-time for Z Communications. He is the author with Robin Hanel of the economic vision named Participatory Economics, and he helped to create the International Organization for a Participatory Society in 2012. Paracon is what we'll be discussing today, but Michael, welcome to the Zero Books channel and podcast. And I just want to let you know that Z Magazine was a very big influence on my own politics. I feel like I've maybe moved away from it a little bit over the last decade, but I appreciate everything you've done for the American left.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Of late, just for the updating of the bio, I guess, I do a podcast titled Revolution Z, and I and the people at PARC, an organization in Indiana, are trying to put together an online school also. But otherwise,
yeah, cool. we'll put a link to your podcast in the description of this video and in the show notes for the podcast, the audio podcast version of this. I wanted to talk to you today about Paracon.
Sure.
And I heard about Paracon originally in the 90s, I believe. I read about it. I used to read a magazine called Anarchy when I was in my 20s, and I considered myself an anarchist. I wasn't sure what kind. And it was when I started reading about Paracon, I read about it from the perspective of some critics on the anarchist left. Some of them were primitivists. And the conversation that emerged at that time in that magazine, I thought in the end was kind of ridiculous. But since then, I have gone through a Marxist turn, and someone who I used to be affiliated with or have a relationship with and no longer do, pointed to Paracon as perhaps the best model for an alternative to capitalist production that was out there, even though he had criticisms of it, and that would be Andrew Kleiman. So I think of Paracon as something that's very serious, that's kind of filling a gap that needs to be worked on more, that people need to be thinking in the way that you're thinking even more. And maybe this isn't the end of the road, but the beginning of the road. But I guess what I'd start with here is just to ask you to describe what Paracon is and how you came to create it.
Well, it stands for participatory economy or participatory economics, short for that. Mm-hmm. We came to create it, myself and Robin Hanel. I guess you would say that stretches all the way back into the 60s. But when we became radicalized, which was a pretty quick phenomenon back then, mm-hmm. When we became radicalized, it wasn't long before we had concerns about what it was that we were trying to achieve, what the goal was. You know, we want the world and we want it now. Well, yeah, what does that mean? We expressed it, we felt it, but then we realized, wait a minute, what are we saying? And that became more prevalent when people asked us and others on the left, okay, what do you want? And often it felt like an attack, right? Since you don't know what you want, you shouldn't be against what is, go home. Mm-hmm. And that was the way it often felt. And I, of course, reacted, as did Robin and virtually all the rest of us, hostily to that. In other words, mm-hmm. you're going to attack us, we're going to attack you back. We don't need to know what we want. We know what exists is garbage. And so we're against it. Well, that mm-hmm. was true. What exists is garbage, so to speak. and being against it is justified, but it was also unwise because it didn't take seriously that people wanted an answer to that, that, you know, to take risks, to invest your time, to invest your energy, to invest your emotional life in trying to win change without knowing what you were trying to win change to, and without a clear belief that it was possible and that it could work and that it would make a difference, was something that not everyone was eager to do, sensibly so. And so we began to think about vision. And that was right. a long, long time ago, and slowly but surely out of that emerged participatory economics.
Right. And in 1968, the students in Paris had a kind of a motto that was like, demand the impossible, mm-hmm. you know, or we don't need theories. You know, our theory is in the streets.
Yeah.
Was that what you were, that kind of sensibility
part
what you were
yeah.
trying to overcome maybe?
Yes, part of it. And it's not as if we didn't empathize with that. We did. You know, we could scream that as loud as anybody. But we also realized that it wasn't a winning strategy, that it wasn't an approach that was going to communicate with most people and address their concerns. And that's become even more pressing in my mind ever since. It seems to me that the biggest obstacle to winning change is having enough people trying to win change in an informed way. And the biggest obstacle to having enough people trying to win change in an informed way is cynicism, is what Margaret Thatcher appealed to, the view that there is no other world. Or even better, Tina, you know, even lacking that you can't win another world. Yeah, sure, maybe it's possible. Great, but you can never get there. Those kinds of beliefs are powerful, deep. I even think they're powerful and deep on the left, among mm-hmm. people who are active, among people who are fighting for change, even among people who call themselves anti-capitalists, say, or anti-racist or anti-sexist. There's this doubt, a deep doubt about winning, and an aversion, therefore, to serious strategy and to seriously answering questions put to us and the rest. Mm-hmm. And that's what led us down that path, you could say, I guess.
Yeah. Even on a practical level, I mean, on a seemingly more immediate and practical level, I recall in the early 2000s when I was getting involved in the peace movement, protesting against the invasion of Afghanistan and the coming invasion of Iraq. Even in the peace movement, there was a feeling that there was no way to stop the American invasion. There was no way to actually stop the war effort. And that what was the task was to voice our displeasure, to be seen as being in opposition, but not to have any practical effect. Yeah. There was never a moment where we had a strategy session where we said, okay, we're going to try this and this and that to try to stop the war. It was just, let's go out and protest and let's try to raise money.
Yeah, there was an old slogan that was like that, fight the good fight, right? And if you think about it, you realize that fight the good fight sort of means, well, you're going to get smashed, but at least put on a good show of it and represent yourself well. And I'm not interested in fighting the good fight. I'm interested in winning. Mm-hmm. And nothing else is enough. Nothing else matters. And the absence of attention to vision, I think, I mean, it's hard to, when you realize what that is, it's hard to explain it. I mean, you can't imagine a sports team not being concerned about figuring out what winning is and how to do it, right?
Right.
And you can't imagine builders not trying to figure out, well, what's the final structure and how do we get to it, right?
Right.
It's inconceivable. And yet in the political realm, in the left realm, it's not only conceivable, it's prevalent. And I think, for me, the thing that lies somehow deep underneath that is the feeling that we can't and not wanting to face that. You know, so in other words, you want to be on the right side and you want to be against injustice and you want to stand up, but you don't want to face this deep feeling that, well, we can't win. And anyway, there's nothing to win. This is the best it is. And so you don't really try. And that's deadening, deadly.
We can explore the psychodynamics of the left and why there's so much resistance to creating a strategy a little bit more in maybe the second hour. But I want to I want to talk about Paracon directly here for the public podcast a little bit. So my understanding is that self-management and workers' councils are kind of the foundational institutions of Paracon, that the starting point is the idea of self-management. And that means the self would be whoever is affected by decisions that are made in productive work or politically. Is that right?
Well, it's one of the key defining values, I guess you could say. I mean, we never thought of it as one as opposed to another. Self-management was a core defining value for us, coming out of anarchist and libertarian socialist traditions. People should have a say in decisions in proportion as they're affected by them. Of course, not down to the, you know, eighth decimal point, but that's a goal to strive for. And if you're going to have that, well, people is in the economy, workers in workplaces, and consumers in where they live in neighborhoods. And if those people, same people with different hats in some sense, but anyway, if those constituencies are going to impact decisions in accord with the degree they're affected by them, where are they going to do that from? And the answer for us was self-managing workers' councils and self-managing consumers' councils. And so, yes, it does. In some sense, I suppose you could say it starts there. But you can have those things and have them washed out, have their efficacy destroyed by other choices. So they are not alone, you know, fundamental. They're critically and centrally important. And carrying through that idea of self-management throughout the economy is, yes, one of the sort of organizing signposts toward arriving at something like participatory economics. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other key, the other key idea for Paracon is that you would change the way or the basis for remuneration. People would be paid differently than they are now. Today, it seems that wages are connected to productivity or how much you contribute, although that's not always the case. But under Paracon, there would be a different set of values dictating how people were paid.
Yeah. Well, also at that early stage, you know, sort of near the bedrock, I don't know what you want to call it, of participatory economics, there's getting rid of capitalism. There's getting rid of ownership, private ownership. So that's also a very, you know, sort of early step in the logic of participatory economics. You can't have people owning the means of production, workplaces, resources, etc. If you have that, you're not going to have self-management, because those people are going to be the dominant decision makers. They're going to be who decides everything. Mm-hmm. But getting to remuneration, which is basically just, you know, what people get in their economic life, we felt like there were just a few proposed possibilities, and that's remained the same decades since. One is that you get income for property. So in other words, Bill Gates and what's his name at Amazon, Jeff Bezos, they get income because they have a piece of paper in their pocket. Ultimately, that's what it is. They have a deed to property, and they get gargantuan amounts of income for that. Okay, so we don't want that. I don't think anybody who thinks about things like equity and justice and people having a say over their own lives could possibly want that, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. So that's gone. The next prevalent option is the one that I think we have, which is a little different than what you suggested. I think in our economy, partly people get income for property, and partly people get income for power. That is bargaining power. So basically, if you have more bargaining power, you can take more. If you have less, you can take less. And so that's a kind of a thug's economy, if you think about it. It's basically an economy in which brute force, bargaining power, causes you to have a higher income. Absence of it causes you to have a lower income. So assuming that we don't, assuming, huh?
I said, look who's back.
Yeah, that's fine with me. I'm fine with that. I used to do this with a parrot on my shoulder, but okay. Not any long. Right. So anyway, we don't want that either. We don't want an economy whose logic, whose internal logic of what you get is basically thuggish. And the next one is liked by a great many socialists. It's a kind of a perspective that has a lot of leftist supporters, ultimately, not always clearly stated. And that is that you should get back in accord with what you contribute to the social pie. So in other words, if I produce bicycles, if I'm a bicycle worker, I should get back as my income something in proportion to what I have produced, the value of what I produce. I don't get back a pile of bicycles, of course, but I get back claims on the social product that are proportionate to what I have contributed to the social product. And Rabin and I thought about that early on and decided, no, this doesn't make sense. This is not a good norm, even though a great many socialists advocate it. Why not? Well, at the most basic level, it rewards luck in what we can call the genetic lottery. If you happen to be born with some incredible talent, skill, strength, etc., you know, your makeup is such that you can be a fullback for the New York Giant football team, or you can play at Wimbledon, or you can sing like Adele, or you et cetera, you have Chomsky's brain, you get more income for it. And for us, it sort of was, you know, the old version that if you're born a capitalist, you're rounding third base and heading for home because of your birthright and what you inherit. But if you're born a worker, you know, you're facing a gigantic pitcher, you're using a matchstick for a baseball bat, and, you know, there's a million fielders out there, and so it's much, much harder. Well, we thought of it sort of analogously. Why, if you're born luckily in the genetic lottery, should you then be showered with great wealth? Why should you earn more for something that you didn't do? You're not having anything, you know, it's just luck. So that was another reason why we didn't like that. It also was because what if you're lucky enough to have better tools, therefore more output, more contribution to the social product, but it's because you were lucky in what we'll call the tool lottery, or you happen to be producing something that is much more valued, or you happen to be working with workmates who are better, right? Why should all these kinds of luck contribute to your income? And what we decided, or what we thought made sense instead, was that you get income for how long you work, and for how hard you work, and for the onerousness of the conditions under which you work. Now, this is virtually the opposite of what we have now, right? Because if you have high bargaining power, you not only earn a lot, but you can work less, and you can work under better conditions, and it's the opposite. But that made sense to us. And then we ran into a little wrinkle. This was in the very early days. Well, wait a minute. What if I go into my back lawn? I start digging holes and filling them in. I tell my kids to shoot the hose at me. And I demand really high income because I'm working long hours under harsh conditions. Right. And I deserve more. Well, obviously, I don't deserve anything because I'm not producing anything of value. Right. And so that's the crucial caveat. That you have to be doing, you get rewarded for duration, intensity, how hard, onerousness, as long as you're producing socially valued projects.
Yeah.
And that's the new norm that we propose for participatory economics.
Well, a couple of thoughts come to me here, and sure. I don't disagree with the value that you're putting forward. I do wonder if we actually live in a society that is based where remuneration is really based on power alone, because it's holding with the kind of a Marxist view. There seems to be a ceiling on the kind of wages you can get, no matter how powerful your union is. What's important is the surplus that you can create, and how expensive the original investment of fixed capital was, and how much reinvestment there needs to be. It seems to me that wages are set based on how much you can get and still produce a surplus for the capitalists and for capitalism itself. Right? I mean, even if the capitalists, have inherited wealth and don't need an income, the capital will need to be invested in and expanded for the business to continue. So even if the owners aren't taking a share at all, there's still going to be a share that has to go into reproducing and expanding the business under capitalism. So the wages are sort of fixed at around what you can get away with on both sides. Like, the capitalist has to pay enough for the worker to survive and come back to work. Can't pay less than that, no matter how little power the worker has, and can't pay more than what can produce a profit that for the business to expand. Would you say that's a better description or fair description of how wages are set?
Yes and no. Honestly, I would say, sure, if you're working for an institution, a capitalist institution, and your bargaining power is high and you're taking more and more, and you're taking so much that the institution can no longer function. That's what you're suggesting, right? That's not viable. Right. Unless you take over the institution and change it. Agreed. I agree with that. But by and large, that's not what's going on. That is to say, workers are not getting so much that they are threatening the existence of the institution. Rather, they're getting closer to, as you describe, a subsistence level. But they're getting more than subsistence. And how much more than subsistence do they get? Well, it might depend on their being unionized or not. It might depend on their having some sort of possession, you could almost call it, whether it's knowledge or skill or experience, right? Which is hard to replace. That's bargaining power. It might depend on whether or not they are black, say, or female as compared to white and male. But why would that be a factor? Well, because if in society there's a profound sexism or racism, that's going to also affect your bargaining power. It's sort of interesting when I have this discussion about this, by the way, doesn't have much bearing on the worth of the vision for participatory economics. It's important for understanding capitalism, but it doesn't really have any bearing on that. But I think it will
actually, Michael, down the line. Because I think that a certain kind of vision about how value is produced, a kind of a Marxist understanding of capitalism, leads to a critique of Perricon, not on its values, but there's a possibility. Yeah, will it work? Will it actually overcome capitalism?
Okay, that's fair. You might want to hear more about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can finish that, and then we should talk about that. I'm fine with talking about that, of course.
Yeah.
But it's interesting when I encounter any number of socialists who say that they sort of favor remuneration for output, right? Many socialists will say that. And so I'll say, I don't believe you do. And they'll say, why? And I would say, well, let's take LeBron James. Do you think he's overpaid or underpaid? And do you think he should be paid as much as he is? And they'll say, way overpaid. No, nobody should earn that much. And I'll say, yeah, well, what's the value of his contribution to the social product? I think that if that's our criteria for how much he should earn, he's underpaid. I think that, in fact, a great deal of that, so to speak, is taken by the owners of the basketball team, Nike, the TV networks, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so actually, LeBron James, we might not like that society values it that much, but it does. The population loves watching him play and enjoys it. So we don't believe that because LeBron James has these intrinsic qualities and these capacities that can so enrich our lives, or Adele, or whoever you want, right, that we should shower them with income. Mm. And then the socialist usually agrees. Anyway.
Right. Well, I mean, to complicate that a little bit, you know, I'm not for the idea that workers should get back what they produce in value. I don't think that is the ultimate. It should be the ultimate aim of. So that's not socialism, in my opinion. So I agree with you. However, you know, in the case of LeBron James, what you're talking about there is really a property relation rather than a value production kind of relation. So it's not. He doesn't produce value in the sense of adding value through the reproduction of commodities and blah, blah, blah. Right. And so
we speak a different language.
Yeah.
And that's just, you know, that makes it a little bit difficult, but not.
Right. Well, right. Right.
For me, he's doing work. Mm-hmm. Right. He's playing ball. Right. And he's running up and down the court. And what's the product? The game, the thing that we watch and we enjoy.
Right. I want to point out that the way I came to speak this Marxism language was after being kind of an anarchist for most of my adult life. And it was like the economic crisis of 2008, mm-hmm. where I said to myself, I don't really understand why this is happening. I need to understand the way the economy works and a little better. And I started interviewing a variety of left economists, and it was the Marxists that explained the world to me in a way that I thought made the most sense. So,
sure.
And we do speak a different language, but there's also, I mean, like, we're also describing the world a little differently. And it's, so it's not just a matter of terminology. It's a matter of how we conceptualize capitalism.
Yeah.
But I'm going to do something with Marx. In the Critique of the Gotha Program, Marx says exactly the same thing that you're saying about remuneration, that the LaSallians, no, it's the Proudhonists, I think, had this idea that each worker would just get back what they contribute. And Marx says, you know, you don't really want that. You want to have social insurance for the elderly and the sick. You want to have, you're going to have to invest in future projects. You know, you don't really want for people to really get back everything they produce. There's a social good that they're producing that we want.
But I'm saying a little more than that.
And furthermore, he said, when you talk about getting back what you produce, you're really talking about inequality rather than equality, precisely for the reasons you said. Some people are stronger than others. Some people are going to the other thing is some people have different needs. Mm-hmm. You know, if a man who has a family or a woman who has a family and has to feed many will have a higher need for remuneration than someone who is living alone, as an example. So it's not exactly fair. Equality doesn't end up being fair for like 1 hour work equals X amount of dollars isn't exactly fair in that instance either. And so for him, the aim was from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. Does that fit into the Pericon vision?
No, that is to say, I empathize with it completely. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the trajectory of your life. And of course, every life has a trajectory. And I was an advocate of that. But after a while, I realized that it sort of has some serious problems. Not the sentiment. The sentiment's fine. But the actuality of it has some serious problems. Mm-hmm. Going back to, first of all, I should probably say, I don't much care what people who lived 100 or 200 years ago said. I just honestly don't. Mm-hmm. The issue isn't finding some forebear who thought something, but being able to express something currently in our own words. So that's just an inclination on my part, I guess.
Right.
Okay. So from each according to ability to each according to needs. My problem is it doesn't mean anything when you start to examine it. From each according to ability. Who determines what my ability is? Does it mean I have to do the thing I'm best at? Does it mean I get to choose whatever I want to do? Does it, what determines that? To each according to needs, same thing. Does that mean that I get to say I need that and that and that, and whatever I say is what I need? Or is somebody deciding what I need? Okay, so that's one problem.
No, I agree with you. There's a lot, it doesn't really answer the question.
Yeah. So that's right. One problem. There's another problem which is more conceptual and interesting, I suppose. And it's that an economy makes choices. And we haven't gotten to this for participatory economics because we were just starting to talk about that. But anyway, in an economy, choices must be made. And for choices to be made, you have to know certain things, or you have to have ideas about certain things. What? Well, how much does a particular choice improve things or hurt things? And to know that, you have to know something about how much people want things, how much people don't want other things, dislike things. It isn't enough just to know that you want something. If you want something more or less, that matters, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's a signpost to what it's good to enlarge versus stand pat with, right? In other words, if we want, take something simple, if we want work that's more fulfilling, right? And we want that a whole lot, well, that's a kind of a message for investment, you can call it, right? We should invest in such a way as that we generate more fulfilling work. Or if everybody needs, I don't know, a fan or an air conditioner, right? And we don't know anything, there's no difference. It's just need. I need it. I want a fan. I need it. I want an air conditioner. I need it. I want a giant pool. I need it. I want a house on the ocean. It doesn't tell you anything about how much society should pay attention to that because it makes a big difference. You understand what I'm saying? So what's missing is that. There are other things missing too, like incentives, right? What is it that causes anybody to do anything? Now, some anarchists will say, well, you're just painting an obnoxious picture of humanity. I far from do that, I think. But if I can have what I say I want, and there's no implication for what I do in terms of work, right? Mm. I'd have to be an idiot to not say I want a whole lot and I would like to do, well, however much I would like to do, right? Mm. But and the anarchist says back, well, but you're a responsible human being and you won't do that. And I say to the anarchist, how do I know what's responsible? How do I know how much is a socially responsible income? How do I know how much is a socially responsible amount of work to contribute to the social product? I don't in your approach. And that's another problem. So mm-hmm. if we go back to remuneration, as I said, in participatory economy, you remunerate for how long you work, how hard you work, and the onerousness of the conditions under which you work. And that gives you an income. And the income is basically a claim on the social product, right? Now you can have a fan or an air conditioner or clothes or food or whatever it is that you want, summing up to your income. And with Marx, in your earlier comment, of course, one also has to be aware that there are a lot of people who can't work, so they just get a full income. There are a lot of people who are sick, so they just get free medical care. So all that is true. So what in the description you gave me of Marx's approach to income, he didn't like the idea that you get back what you've produced, because some of what you've produced has to go to the social, to those social needs.
Right.
To say free medical care or daycare or support for people who can't work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, first of all, there are collective goods and they're part of participatory economics. But just to take that, I agree, of course. But let's say you do all that, right? So let's say you've allotted all that part of the social pie, the social product. So now instead of a giant pie, you have a somewhat smaller pie because some of it's going to all that. Right. And now the question still remains, well, what size piece do I get? Right. It still remains. And if you remember what I said at the beginning was remuneration for output. In other words, you should get something in proportion to your output. I didn't say you should get all of it. So I was already doing better than what Marx was criticizing. I wasn't advocating it, but I was putting forward best case. So you allot all that. Now, is it appropriate that you get in proportion to the amount that you contributed? And my answer is still no, right? It's not, right? Because it rewards luck in the genetic lottery. It rewards luck in the tool lottery. It rewards luck in the in happening to produce things that are more valued by people, and so on. And so Robin and I arrived at duration, intensity, and onerousness of socially valued labor. Now, can that work? That's a different question, right? And the usual critique is, that's nice. It's ethically nice. I agree, says the critic. However, the incentives are completely botched, right? You, where's the incentive for somebody to be a doctor? Where is the incentive, you know, to do anything other than anything else? Because the amount that you earn is not a function of the product. It's a function of how long you work, how hard you work, and how much. So the person will say, "I'd instead of being a doctor, right, which takes years and years of horrible training and schooling, and then I become a surgeon, say, I'm not going to do that. I'll just take a, I'll flip hamburgers, or I'll work in the coal mine because I can earn the same amount. In fact, if we don't change the division of labor, I could probably earn more, right? Because it's more onerous, and it's and it, you know, I can work at it more intense, etc. And so the person says your incentives are all wrong. Society will flounder because the pie will be distributed fairly, ethically. But the pie will be too small, right? Because there won't be sufficient incentives.
Right.
And the response to that is relatively simple. The fact is, there is no incentive to have a genetic to have a better genetic endowment. It's nonsense to think that because we pay LeBron James enough as an incentive for him to have a better genetic endowment. That's ridiculous. It's also true that it is not the ideal way to generate effective workplaces, efficient workplaces in which equipment is used well and labor is used well. There's no, you don't have to reward the people to do that. That's what we show in the model. And what we are rewarding is precisely, right, what people have control over, how long they work, how hard they work, and whether they're willing to work under onerous conditions. And so the incentive is precisely right. It is the thing that I have a say as a worker over whether I'm going to do it or not is precisely the things that the remuneration incentivizes. And so it does provide incentive. And the person will say, you're still crazy. Nobody's going to be a doctor. And I've used this example a million times. And I say, well, first of all, you have to realize that, of course, going to medical school is work. You're producing the knowledge and, you know, so that, so you're remunerated for it. But nonetheless, imagine you're both getting out of high school. Two people are both getting out of high school and they're making a choice about their life. And the choice is coal mining or surgery, or make it any other comparable kind of choice. And they're trying to decide. And what you want me to believe is that the surgeon who goes to college instead of the coal mine, who goes to medical school instead of the coal mine, and who is a you know, a young doctor working ridiculous hours instead of the coal mine, right, needs to be paid $500,000 a year to avoid to get them to be willing to be a surgeon. And I say, I don't believe that. So make believe that you're that kid getting out of high school and making the choice. And I'm going to start lowering the wage for the surgeon. And you tell me when it's so low that you will go and switch over into the coal mine instead of going to college, going to medical school, being an intern, and then being a surgeon. And I've done it with medical students who, before I do it, they say, you're insane. I'm not going to, you know, And then when I do the experiment with them and I start lowering the income from 700,000 to 600,000 to 500,000 to 400,000, and I keep going, and they finally say to me, I'm not sure. What's the lowest salary I can live on? Because I'm not going into the damn coal mine.
Right.
And so we have, and what I think is most fascinating about this is the extent to which, I don't know whether to call it indoctrination, popular culture, education, whatever you want to call it, can maintain in the population, including the educated and aware population, often even mostly the educated and aware population, total myths, total mythology, right? Perceptions of reality which bear no relationship to reality, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of fascinating. But anyway, the point is that, you know, first of all, when you start remunerating for education and when you start dealing with the characteristics of work, all of this changes in a participatory economy. But even if you're just considering the ethics of remuneration and the incentives of remuneration, equitable remuneration, that's what we call it, is vastly superior.
Yeah, and one thing that's important about what you described there was not only the ethical remuneration, but also the sharing of work and of socially rewarding work as well. Because I could easily come up with a counter to your description of the surgeon who would take very little money in order to avoid going to the coal mine by saying, well, look, you start paying surgeons less and they'll become bankers.
But the bankers are in less too.
Right. You have to do that. But you know, like if you, in this society, they will go where they can get the most and also get the most social prestige. Right. So if you're going to have to balance it out a bit, but the other important thing is to widen the pool of people who can compete for those positions to be surgeons. And that means, sharing the kinds of work more equitably as well as, and that's a big part of Paracon as well.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Very big. So far we have no more private ownership, self-managing workers and consumers councils, and remuneration for duration, intensity, and onerousness of work. Mm-hmm. And now you come to what I think is maybe the most controversial, although people aren't always willing to say that it's the most controversial part of participatory economics. And it is about the division of labor. It's not about getting rid of the division of labor. There's no such thing as getting rid of the division of labor. That would mean we all do exactly the same things. Okay, we'd all starve to death. You know, Margaret Thatcher would be right. That's ludicrous. You can't. We'd all do 1/1,000th of the million tasks, right? A million. It's just ridiculous. Okay, so that's out. So what's wrong with the division of labor? You know, why is it a problem? And my answer to that is that it's not that we do different things. That's not only okay. It's absolutely essential. Right. And also we have different tastes. I mean, it is even good, right? It's that we divide up work in capitalist economies and in what were called socialist economies in a manner which says, basically, let's take a bunch of empowering tasks and put them together into a job. And let's take a bunch of disempowering tasks and put them together into a job. And by empowering, I mean doing the work. The effect of the work on you enlightens, gives you additional knowledge of the workplace, gives you confidence, gives you a sense of efficacy, gives you connections with others, etc., and leaves you energetic as well. And over here in the disempowering side, the combination of tasks diminishes your social skills, diminishes your contact with others, exhausts you, deadens you, right? Diminishes your knowledge, and so on. So one is disempowering, one is empowering. And it turns out that the disempowering jobs, by and large, are about 80% of the workforce, roughly speaking. And the empowering jobs are about 20% of the workforce. And what happens is, remember now, in typical systems, bargaining power is very important. Well, the 20% have tons of bargaining power compared to the 80%, unless the 80% get together and organize and fight. But that doesn't come from, you know, their humanity or their economic position. It comes from organizing. All right. So right. By virtue of the economy, the 20% are dominant over the 80%. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I find to be bad about what I'll call the corporate division of labor. But that doesn't mean capitalist corporation. It means sort of a particular structure, because it also held in essentially what's been called socialism. So anyway, what's the solution? What can you possibly do about that? And the answer, I think, is trivial. It's hard to see, perhaps because we have such an ingrained picture in our minds, right? But it's rather simple. Instead of putting all the empowering work in 20% of the jobs and the disempowering work in 80% of the jobs, you know, to oversimplify a little bit, divide the 20% among all the jobs, divide the 80% among all the jobs. So you do a mix of tasks. You have a mix of responsibility. And now lots of things change. So for instance, education changes. We no longer have education, which provides the 20% with means and confidence and knowledge to exert their authority in society, and the 80% learn to endure boredom and take orders, which is basically what the school system does for about 80% of the population.
Right.
That disappears.
I have a question about this, and it's just a technical question. But, you know, if you are talking about the socially rewarding and often more intellectual work, right?
I'm not.
But you're not talking about more. No,
I'm talking about, I'm saying something very explicit.
Mm-hmm.
Let me describe it this way. So workers take over a workplace in capitalism in Argentina.
You're talking about sharing the kinds of work that are social rewarding and more empowering.
That are more empowering. Are not socially rewarded. Remember back in remuneration where I said you get income for duration, intensity, and onerousness?
Yeah.
Okay. So if jobs are not comparably, don't have comparable onerousness, then you get more income for that, right?
Not talking about remuneration. I'm just talking about, hear what I'm going to say before you interpret.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, all right. So maybe I'm not expressing myself very well, but my understanding is that the kinds of work that maybe managers would do, the people that top 20% that dominate, is usually more socially rewarding in so much as it has social status, but also it involves developing your social skills. As you described it, it maybe even leaves you energized rather than tired. One of the things about that kind of work, and to varying degrees, is that it requires an investment of time and energy in order to specialize and become an expert in that kind of work. And if you spread it out amongst everyone and gave everyone the opportunity to do that kind of work, regardless of their genetic predisposition or regardless of whether or not you think they could ever develop the skills, I think they could. Okay. And I don't have any problem with that. I do wonder if anyone would be able to focus and have the time to develop the skill if they're also having to do other kinds of work which are more onerous and which are more repetitive and which are less rewarding. How would you get around that in Paracon?
Okay. There's two issues here. How big of a problem is it?
Right. I don't know how big it is. I may be overestimating it.
Okay. How big of a problem is it? And then how do you get around it? Yeah. So to the first issue, I honestly don't think it's a very big problem. I think that most work, let's call it, is not of the sort that you need a tremendous amount of prior training and education, so much so that it would rule out anything else, and of ongoing training and education. I don't think that.
And, has and, there been and studies actually, on this? Have you, is there, are, do you have, are there studies about this?
At no. I don't know. Maybe there are, but I'm not aware of them. But there are situations that bear upon it, I suppose you could say. You know, workplaces that are taken over, and the coordinator class, that's what I call the 20%, leaves. Why? Because the workplace was failing, the capitalist was leaving, the 20% think it's totally fucked, there's no chance, I'm going too, and the workers take over. And when that happens, you still have to, you have to do the finance books. You know, you still have to do things, right? And so workers have to rise into those positions. And incredibly, they do, in very short order, relatively speaking. And so you find that, you know, somebody who was from the working class background and had a working class education and was spending their time, you know, in front of a blast furnace is now doing the finances. And, you know, it's only months. So that's one indicator.
But that person,
that's not being a surgeon. That's not being a surgeon.
Right. And also, and that person that became the in charge of finances didn't have to keep doing work in front of the blast furnace.
No, well, that depends. But it, by and large, people who are doing things like finances spend a whole lot of their time doing nothing or chattering. Right. So yeah. It's not true. Right. And that's true. That's even true for surgeons. Right. Mm-hmm. But let's take the extreme scenario. Suppose all surgeons worked 40 hours a week now doing nothing but cutting and sewing. Right. Surgery. Mm-hmm. It's not true. But suppose they did. And suppose I come along and say, can't do that anymore because we've discovered, I think it would be the case, but we don't know for sure yet, right? We've discovered that doing surgery is very empowering. It actually sort of makes you think you're God. So it has, but anyway, doing surgery is very empowering. And so you can do it. We need surgeons. We're not getting rid of surgery. We're not getting rid of expertise, but you have to also clean bedpans or whatever, all right? So now the surgeon is spending a certain amount of time not schmoozing, not running after, you know, next sexual partner, not attending meetings about how to keep down the nurses, none of those things, because that's all gone, right? But they are doing some tedious work, right? Some bedpans or whatever. Mm-hmm. And your question is, does that mean the surgeons will become worse because they will, you know, lose their skill? Well, I don't think that's a serious problem. And I also think that there's a different index, I suppose we could call it, to look at, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the unleashing of the potential, now potential and not actualized, but in the future actualized talents, capacities, energies of the 80%, yeah. Right? Which I think way more than makes up for any of these, for example, that the old surgeons, right, are no longer doing surgery 50 hours, but now they're doing it 25 hours. Well, big deal. New surgeons are coming in.
You've convinced me. Okay. I'm convinced now. I don't even need a scientific study.
Well, we'll get scientific studies because another fact is participatory economics is not going to arrive like that, right? Right. We're not going to switch from what we have to this. We will win a series of changes. We will engage in very difficult struggles, and along the way, we'll learn more, and we'll become more aware of what's possible and what isn't, and if need be, of changes that have to occur in our vision of what can occur. But I would say that at the start, we probably shouldn't try and shortchange ourselves. We should probably go for what we really want. And what I really want is classlessness, and that means we can't have owners, but it also means we can't have people who monopolize the empowering circumstances in the economy.
Yeah,
right. We have to get rid of that.
I agree. Sure. So we've been talking for about 53 minutes. What I thought we might do now is take a little break and then do a second recording. Because I have some questions for you, not about Paracon per se, but how about the process of developing something like Paracon or a vision of beyond capitalism. And we ran up against this problem of that we speak a little bit different language, right? I had this doctrinaire Marxist and you're an anarchist. And what I realized was that, I mean, like you and I have the same basic vision of how to get to the kind of world we want. And the differences in our language and our conceptions are such that sometimes it's hard to even critique each other in good faith and you know, to get to, and that I wonder to what degree the kind of a rising sectarian nature of left struggle gets in the way of developing a vision and what we might do to get around.
A whole lot, I think.
Yeah.
A whole lot. Yeah. I'm happy to talk about that stuff. If you, by chance, ever want to have a repeat, I mean, we didn't get that far into what participatory economics
is. I know.
Maybe that's okay. I'm not, you know, but maybe we could do it some other time.
Yeah, we should do some more on participatory economics. You know, my trouble here is also like I think I understand your vision, and my goal is not primarily, and it's selfish maybe, primarily to communicate that vision, which I think people can get, but to engage you in a kind of critical reflection and see if we can, if I can understand it better through critique or something. But I think what we got here instead was just a very scratching of the surface of both those things. Hopefully in the second hour we'll do better. And yes, absolutely, you can come back. And not only would I like it if you came back onto the podcast once, but if you actually end up writing a book for Zero Books around these issues, you'll have an opportunity to come on to the channel many, many times on your own with me to promote that book and your ideas. So
I will take that very seriously, and I'll see what I can do.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.